Okay, good morning, ladies. Sheet 27. Now, there are so many interesting things happening on this sheet and this topic. Some of them are bothering on different levels. Some of them are actually very helpful to understand what's really going on different levels. First of all, who had in this room had come across this issue before of the missing 165 years? Fagi? Jessica?
I guess so.
You've heard of this before?
Yeah.
Right. Like as if everyone's heard of it. The title on the sheet. The title on the sheet says. The title on the sheet says Bait Sheni V'Hashanim Ma'avudot, meaning the lost years, the missing years, the years that got lost. And the question is, there are two issues here going in parallel. The first issue is the specific issue of the years. You know, how do we explain that? What's the problem? What are the solutions? But actually on a scale of 1 to 100, it's not actually a very critical issue in terms of Jewish religious thinking. For reasons that we'll talk about soon. So I don't think as an issue in and of itself it's that important. But as a paradigm, you know what I mean by paradigm? Mm-hmm. Meaning as an example of how to deal with an issue. We are faced from time to time in Jewish life with conflicts between what we perceive as being a Torah position, what we perceive as being a side position, and these sometimes come into conflicts with each other. How do we deal with that? Do we ignore the science or academia? Do we tell ourselves that it's wrong? Do we say that the Torah is wrong? And if so, what does that mean to say that the Torah is wrong? And is that a problem? And in what way are we saying wrong? Because obviously it sounds inappropriate to say the Torah is wrong, but maybe that means that we've misunderstood our understanding of the Torah is wrong. That could be definitely the case. Or do we turn around and say that, no, these things exist in parallel planes, and that's talking about this, and that's talking about the other thing, and we don't have to be upset about it. I think this is very important because it comes up in a few areas. This is a minor example. Another example which you might come across over time is evolution, scientific accounts for the origins of the universe, which some people say are against or conflicting with the Torah accounts for the beginning of the universe. Are they not? Is the science right? Is the science wrong? Do we care? How do we understand Bereishis, etc.? Another example could be biblical criticism, where people will say to you over the course of your life at university that the academic model for the origin of the Bible is very different from the classic Jewish, or for that matter, the classic Christian model for the origin of the Bible. The academic model for the origin of the Bible has multiple authors and an editor and all sorts of things like this. How do we as Jews, as Orthodox Jews, as people who take the Chumash as the Dvar Hashem, how do we relate to those kind of shitot, those kind of approaches? Do we just belittle them and ridicule them? Do we try and synthesize them somehow? These are points that if you don't come to grips with now, you'll have to deal with them later. And therefore, one of my reasons for bringing up this topic now, even though many of you could possibly get through life quite happily without even having heard of it, I think it's important that you hear about it now. Number one, because you'll hear about it eventually. Number two, because the methodology is important. Okay? Now, it may be that all the solutions that we have for this particular problem are unsatisfactory. That could well be. But I want to see at least how Rabbi Schwab deals with it, and you'll see what you think of Rabbi Schwab's suggestion and his later apparent retraction of that suggestion. Okay, guys, I'm not going to obviously read through this whole thing, but I want to just point out a couple of interesting issues. First of all, let's take Rabbi Schwab's first article. He wrote this article back in the 1960s. The 1960s sounds like a long time ago these days. But that's the decade that I was born that long ago, or maybe it really is. But he wrote this around 50 years ago in a collection of essays. Rav Shimon Schwab is obviously one of the very senior figures in the Jewish world, in the Orthodox world, in the world of Torah. He was the Rav for many, many years of the Royal Shul in Washington Heights. Okay, what's it called, the Adas Yishurun, Adas Yishurun Shul, up in Washington Heights, very senior figure, one of what people would have regarded as the Gedolei Yisrael, the senior poskim. And he, of course, as a German Jew originally, he knows full well about this academic problem, and he wants you to know about it as well, to know how to deal with it. Have a look here in A. The problem in a nutshell is this. I'm sure you can all... I mean, you tell me what the problem is. Tell me what the problem is. What are the two sides of the problem? What is the conflict? Tell me. Yes, George.
Right, so, we believe that there were four kings in this life-sustainable time period, which lasted about 34 years?
Yeah, 30-something years.
Yeah, and modern historians believe that they were actually 10 kings.
Right.
Significantly longer.
Right. That, in a nutshell, that's the problem. You have the beginning of the Bayis Sheni period, or the end of the Bayis Rishon period, let's say. The Jews were taken away by Babel. This is all very easy. Babel itself was, Babylonia was taken over by Persia. There was a certain period of Persian rulership during which we came back to Eretz Israel and started rebuilding the second base of Mikdash. This is all undisputed. Everybody agrees on this. Eventually, the Persian Empire was taken over by the Greeks. Alexander the Great. We then found ourselves under the control of the Greeks, hence the Hanukkah story, Antiochus, etc., etc., and the rest, as they say,
is
history. Okay? That much is agreed on. The question is, how much of this Persian period was there? The Jewish perspective is that there were three or four kings. Have a look for a second at the sheet that I gave you, sheet 27. I'll just bring you a couple of sources that you can get a little bit of background on this. So, Daniel, living in the early Bayis Sheni period, or the between Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni period, he says the following here. Va'ata, emes agid lach. I'm going to tell you the truth now. Hine oid shloshu malachim oindim lefaras. There will be three kings coming in Persia. V'haravi, but the fourth king, Yashir Oishir Godel, will have great wealth, Mikol of more than all, Ukechez Kasei, Va'ashrei, Yair Hakol et Malchus Yavan. And he will, if you like, overwhelm Malchus Yavan, the kingdom of Greece. Va'amud Melech Gibor, and then a great king will arise, Umashal, Mimshal, Ravan will rule over everything, Va'asakitzon, and he'll be able to do what he likes. So the book of Daniel has got many of these fairly unclear, obscure-looking predictions. There's going to be this number of kings and this number of years and this number of etc. He's looking forward into the Bayis Sheni period. Even though Daniel was a Navi, his work is not included in Nevi'im. His work is included in Ksuvim. You'll find it just before Divrei HaYamim, around the book of Ezra. Okay. The question is, what is he talking about? So we have a book called Seder Olam Rabbah. Seder Olam Rabbah is a book. You can buy it. Okay, you can buy it in English translation. It was written in the time of the Tanaim. It is attributed to Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalasta is one of the students of Rabbi Akiva. So you can place it very clearly in Jewish history. Seder Olam Rabbah goes from the beginning up until its own time, plugging all of the dates in. Some of them are very easy. You just open the Tanakh. This one lived this long, and then he begat this many, and then he died. And this one lived this long, and then he had this many children. That's all very easy. There are certain other things. When it says in the Chumash there were 400 years of the exile in Egypt, there were 430 years, it fits everything together. For example, you know as well as I do, the 400 years that it talks about in Mitzrayim, how many, were we actually 400 years in Mitzrayim?
No.
How do we count the 400 years? From? Leidat Yitzchak, from the birth of Yitzchak. That's Seder Olam Rabbah. Then elsewhere it says 430 years in Mitzrayim. Where do we count that from? From where? The Brit Ben Abatarim with Avraham Avinu when he was 70. Meaning, all of this information that you know, that you've learnt in Chumash, is all, to a large degree, in terms of dates, coming from Seder Olam Rabbah. Now, Seder Olam Rabbah tells us that there are X number of kings. Have a look at Rashi. Key number two. V'hine oish loish malachim. Chazal oimru, says Rashi, Chazal said, B'Seder Olam Rabbah, in Seder Olam Rabbah, who are these kings? Ze Koresh. You've heard of Koresh, right?
Yeah.
Beginning of the Second Temple, it's Koresh. V'Achashveirosh. You've heard of Achashveirosh. V'Dariyavesh, and Dariyavesh. Shebana Habayis. And he was the one that authorized the second kingdom, the second temple to be built. There's a Medrash that said he was the son of Esther, Chashverosh, etc., etc. Umatamadom Ravi, and who is Ravi? Ravi Lamadai. There was a fourth king who was a king of Madai, of Medea, which was not a king of Persia. One second. So he first quotes Seder Olam Rabba and says, these are the kings. But then what does he do? And this is very interesting as to what Rashi does next. He says, Aval b'sefer Yosef ben Gurion. But in the book of Yosef ben Gurion, who is Yosef ben Gurion? Who is Yosef ben Gurion? What do we normally call him?
Josephus.
Yosef ben Gurion is Josephus. What? Okay, so Yosef ben Gurion, as far as I'm aware, is the same guy. I think he's quoting Josephus, no? Unless he's quoting Yosipun. Yosipun is a later work, which I thought he was close to quoting Josephus here, but maybe I'm wrong. But he's quoting someone complete, which is not Chazal, but say for Yosef ben Gurion, I'm pretty sure he's quoting Josephus. Kosov, he writes there, Shehayaloi ben Lekoresh, then Koresh actually had a son, Shemalak Tachtav, who reigned after him, Lifnei Meloi Chachashverosh, before Achashverosh, Ushmoi, and his name was Bambisa. Cambyses. Okay? Now, I'm not interested, girls, in the specific Persian history. I really don't think this is the place to learn dates, times, people, etc. However, what's Rashi just done? He's quoted Seder Olam Rabba, and then what's he quoted? A non-Chazal source, which disagrees, and says actually there were other kings, or at least in this case, one other king, that wasn't included in Chazal. Bambisa. Okay? Again, you don't have to remember his name, Abby. But I want you to just understand what Rashi just did here. He quoted Chazal, and then he said, yeah, but there are other sources as well. There are other sources that say things slightly different. And he's not bothered by this. He just quotes it, and he goes on to say, and the last king he talks about is Alexander the Great, etc. Rabbi Schwab points out something which was known, by the way, for thousands of years. Rassad Yugon talks about this. The Abarbanel talks about this. In fact, let me show you a book which I bought a few years ago, which was written by this fellow here, Mitchell First, who is a rav from YU. He did this as his MA thesis, and the book is entirely dedicated to this question, Jewish History in Conflict, a study of the major discrepancy between rabbinic and conventional chronology. Okay? It doesn't make for fascinating bedtime reading, but it is a very interesting book, and he's put together hundreds of shitas, hundreds of different people over the years, including Rabbi Schwab, modern history books, the R Scroll history books, people, Rabbi Beryl Wine, you've heard of Beryl Wine, and some classic shitas, Rav Sadia Gaon, Yossi Tun, which is not Josephus, which is a book from the 10th century, which could be that's what Rashi's quoting, although I don't remember exactly. The Abarbanel, Azariah de Rossi, various different people who all deal with this question in different ways. So don't think that Rabbi Schwab was the one that just discovered this. This is a well-known question going all the way through the Mephoroshim from the time of the Gaonim onwards. Comes along Rabbi Schwab and says, okay, we have Seder Olam Rabba. It says that the second Beit HaMikdash lasted 420 years and the dates worked such and such a way. However, go now to Rabbi Schwab's article and look at number 4. Little number 4 on where it says page 180 at the bottom of the page. And I want to bring this to your attention. I just love the way he puts it. You see it? Little number 4? You with me where it says the Torah true historian? He says the Torah true historian is now confronted with a truly vexing problem. Meaning, I believe in the Torah. I'm also a historian, he says. What can we do with this? Ancient history of the Babylonian and Persian empires presents us with completely different data. Now, we saw already Rashi mentioned a non-Chazal source and put that in, but he says, forget about that for a second, look at the Babylonians and the Persians. These figures can hardly be doubted, for they appear to be the result of painstaking research by hundreds of scholars and are borne out by profound erudition and by ever-increasing authoritative evidence. Does Rabbi Schwab take the academic record seriously or not?
Yeah.
Yes. He says, painstaking research, hundreds of scholars, profound erudition, ever-increasing authoritative evidence. In fact, one of the things they discovered in the 20th century, which they hadn't known previously, is they discovered how to read cuneiform. What's cuneiform? What's cuneiform?
Is there another Rosetta
Right. All that stuff, you know, when you read on the Persian and Assyrian, you know, all that stuff that, you know, that looks like this, you know, and all this, you know, and all that stuff. I don't know how to draw cuneiform. But they learned how to decipher cuneiform. And lo and behold, the cuneiform record agrees almost exactly with the ancient Greek academic and historical records, which talk about the number of kings. So it's not that you can just turn around and say, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, academics have got an agenda, they're just trying to do this, they're trying to do that. Says Rav Schwab, he's not prepared to accept that approach. Although that is an approach that some people have taken. Meaning, what do you do when you have science or academia conflicting with Torah? So you have a number of possible approaches. Either you can turn around and say, there is no conflict because the science is wrong. Ah, but the scientists think it's right. Yeah, but the scientists may be wrong because science is very often overturned. In other words, you can discredit the science side. Now, to a certain degree, that is legitimate, because how much science which is taught today will be understood to be scientifically accurate in 300 years' time? Not very much. On the other hand, certain things are unlikely to change. You know, they may turn around and look back and say that, for example, the Newtonian model of the universe, I'm not a scientist, but Newtonian physics, and the basic interactions between mass, gravity, all that kind of stuff, were, up until the early 20th century, considered to be the last word in physics. Read about what the early 20th century physicists say about how much is left to be discovered in physics. And they'll say there's almost nothing left to be discovered. There's some amazing quotes that basically say that. Came along Einstein in the early 20th century and overturned the entire understanding of Newtonian physics, with the whole theory of relativity, general relativity, special relativity, etc., etc., where he said that some of these Newtonian constants were not as constant as you thought at all. Time is not constant, mass is not constant, depending on speed, etc., equals mc squared and all those things like that. Now, I'm not a scientist, so don't listen to me talking about science. But what clearly happened is a major revolution in scientific thinking. Who's to say there won't be another one in 50 years, in 100 years, in 120 years? On the other hand, it's highly unlikely that they will conclude that the Earth really is flat. It's highly unlikely. Meaning, some things will change, but some things will not. So, you can estimate to say, leave the science is wrong. So, evolutionary theory, to a certain degree, is borne out by evidence, and to a certain degree, is speculative. Now, I'm not the one to talk to you about evolutionary theory, and you can get a scientist talking about that. So, one approach is to discredit the science, or to say the science will change. Another approach may be to turn around and say, then maybe you misunderstood the science. Maybe you're thinking of the science in an oversimplistic way. Speak to other scientists. Another approach will be, maybe you misunderstood the Torah. Meaning, if you stand up and say, I can't sleep at night because the account of evolution disagrees with Bracious, then the very strong likelihood is that you don't understand what's really going on in Bracious. You're massively oversimplifying the story. You're reading it in English. I don't know, you're listening to some fundamentalist Christian account of the creation of the world who won't teach evolution in the schools in Texas because they you know, say, I'm sorry, that's not the Chumash. You may be reading the Bible, but you're not reading the Chumash. You massively misunderstood the science. Okay? The Torah, excuse me. So maybe you can say you misunderstood the science. Maybe you can say you misunderstood the Torah. Maybe you can turn around and say, and I'm going to show you a quote in a couple of weeks, maybe at the end of this week, from Rabbi Sachs's book. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs has wrote a wonderful book on this called The Great Partnership. You should read that book. If you are bothered in any way by these issues, and I'm not saying you should be. Maybe you don't care, you can take care less about these issues. If you are bothered about science, academia stroke Torah issues, then you should read Rabbi Sachs's book called The Great Partnership. It is probably the most important book, readable book, on these issues written in the last 30 years. Go onto Amazon, pick it up. It costs about $25. It is the best $25 you could invest at this stage, in my personal opinion. I will bring you an extract from that when we talk about the Greeks and Hanukkah when we get onto that. But his thesis is that there's no contradiction here. There's no contradiction here. Because they're doing different things. Rav Soloveitchik, we'll talk more about that later. Rav Soloveitchik said that even about biblical criticism, which is amazing on a certain level. He said, I can read the Chumash on the one hand and have absolute emunah, that this is the Dvar Hashem from Moshe Rabbeinu. And I can learn biblical criticism on another hand as an academic construct. And one doesn't bother me, the one doesn't bother the other in the slightest. They're two different things, doing two different tasks, and they don't even touch each other in the sense of emunah at all. And once one can get deeper to understand how that works. But Rabbi Schwab is bothered. He's bothered by the academic record, and he's not prepared to say that it's not true. He's not prepared to say that the scientists are wrong, and he has a major problem on his hands, which is that according to the non-Jewish dating system, the Second Temple period lasts much longer. It's not 420 years. It's more like 585 years, right? Which means that there's a lot of missing years. What happened in these missing years? Where are they and why are they missing during the Second Temple period? And Taka, when you open up history books, open up Jewish history books, you'll see that some of them use the Chazal dating system when it comes to BCE, and some of them use the conventional system. For example, if you open up the Art Scroll book of Jewish history, you'll not be surprised to find that they use the Chazal system, not the conventional system. Whereas if you open up the Da'at Mikra book of Chumash, which you have in the library upstairs, in the Bet Midrash upstairs, which is produced by Mossad HaRav Kook, which is an ever so frum Orthodox institution, they make without any explanation at all. They use the conventional chronology. They use the academic chronology. They don't use the Chazal Seder Olam Rabbah chronology. They use the other one. So, you know, which are you going to use? Because there are Orthodox people using both, and therefore this is something that one has to understand a little bit. Have a look here in number 6, because number 6, I think, is one of the most interesting paragraphs of all. The gravity of this intellectual dilemma posed by such enormous discrepancies must not be understated. Meaning, don't just brush this under the carpet and say, ugh, I don't believe in this. Don't understate it. The unsuspecting students, I'm going to separate you two in a minute. Smiling too much. They're smiling out of my... People think you're enjoying my class if you smile. That's not acceptable. Okay? The unsuspecting students, that's you guys, including the pupils of our yeshivot and Beit Yaakov high schools. I love the fact that the Rabbi Schwab thinks that the Beit Yaakov high schools are going to be learning this issue. Okay? But he says, and he's not being funny here, he's saying that, of course, any highly educated young woman in our Beit Yaakov system will be aware of this issue. I mean, why would they not be? Okay? Are faced with a puzzle. What's the matter, Joy? Okay, are faced, that's because you didn't go to school in the 1960s, okay, are faced with a puzzle that appears insoluble. How could it have been that our forefathers had no knowledge of a period in history otherwise widely known and amply documented which lasts over a span of 165 years, which were less than 600 years from the time of the sages, recording in Seder Olam Rabbah? In other words, this wasn't lost in the mists of prehistory. Rabbi Yosef ben Chalafta lived a few hundred years after this period. Is it really possible to assume that some form of historical amnesia had been allowed to take possession of the collective memory of an entire people? I don't think we go for that. This should be quite like assuming that some group of recognized historians of today will publish a textbook on medieval history, ignoring all the records of, say, the 13th and 14th century. Fine. 7. This is enormous discrepancy between sacred tradition and secular data would appear at first sight to frustrate any and all hope that it might be possible to compile a comparative chronology. But he comes up with a solution. Does he reject the secular chronology? The conventional chronology? Does he reject the academics? Yes or no?
No.
No. Does he reject Chazal? Yes or no?
No.
No. So what does he do? He makes a suggestion, for which he says he can bring proof, and he brings some interesting proof. What is his suggestion? What? They did it. He says that Chazal, at the beginning of the, during the Second Temple period, purposely created Seder Olam Rabbah in such a way to miss out these 165 years. Why? Why? This is his idea, by the way. Something to do with revealing Mashiach. He said, in other words, there was a mitzvah. He says there's a pasuk in Daniel that says Daniel has to obscure the time for the coming of Mashiach. Yeah, totally. Now that's a well-known thing. That the idea for the Mashiach will be obscured in some way. He says a number of things happen to make this the case. For example, just 1 second, Michal. He makes the point, and this is a historical, indisputable point. From the middle of the Greek period, we started counting the years from what we call the Minyan Shtarot. Have you come across this before? The Minyan Shtarot. Meaning, if you went back 500, 600, 700 years, to your forebears and asked them what was the year, it's very unlikely they would have used the year that we use today, meaning the year from creation. Jewish people didn't used to count from those years.
How did they used to count? During the time of Rashi, how did the Jewish people used to count? They used to count what they called Minyan Shtarot, which was the year one was at the beginning of the Seleucid area of the Greeks. And that's how they counted the years. We have many Ketubot.
Why did they start from the Greeks?
Why were they started from the Greeks? Why all of a sudden? And it's not just the Jews. Many non-Jews in the area started from that period of time as well. You pick up a Ketubah from the 9th, 10th century. It doesn't say in the year 4, 7, whatever it was. It says in the year 2, whatever it was, because it counts from the Minyan Shtarot. Why would they do that? What's that? No, it's nothing to do with AD. It's a completely different system. AD was a church system which came in much later on, okay? Obviously counting back to the beginning of Christianity.
What's
CE? CE is what we call AD.
Oh.
Because we don't call it AD because AD means Anno Domini, means in the year of our Lord, which obviously is not really appropriate if you're not a Christian. So we call it CE, Common Era. But again, I'm telling you something you may not have known. Jewish people didn't use either the count we use today, or AD, or CE, or anything like that. They used the Minyan Shtarot. Says Rav Schwab, one of the reasons was part of this whole kind of cutting out these years. And he brings other proofs as well, and he comes to the conclusion that actually we're 165 years further on in the calendar than we thought we were. Meaning, today's year is not 5775, it is 5940. Meaning that the year 6000 is just around the corner. We thought it was a couple of hundred years away, but it's really not. It's just around the corner. Then at the end of the article he says, how are we allowed, if there was a mitzvah to cover it up, how is Rabbi Schwab allowed to uncover it? And therefore he says archaeology is shared, meaning it's uncovered itself. It's uncovered itself because the archaeology has now revealed the system. Now, what do you think of Rabbi Schwab's thesis?
If he's saying that they had to cover up a time period, that means there's something in that time period that would have somehow revealed to us the coming of Mashiach.
If you're going with the 6,000 years, it means that the 6,000 years are much more easily calculable, and therefore Mashiach is much more easily identifiable.
5,940?
5,940, he says we're in.
I thought you said that there's another
sheet of paper. Oh, so first of all, is the 6,000 years really going to be when Mashiach comes? For example, we're all familiar with this Gemara. It's a Gemara in Makkos, I believe. Is it Makkos or is it Brochus? Can't remember exactly now. The Gemara says, basically, I think it's Makkos, that there are basically three lots of 2,000 years. The first 2,000 years, you all know this, right? The first 2,000 years are the years of Tova Bohu, before there was any Torah. The second 2,000 years are the years of Torah, which is from, where did it start from? Oh, come on, this is basic knowledge. No. From Avram Avinu. Starts from Avram Avinu, year 2000. That's when he suddenly discovers, over time he discovers God. And it goes up until the Mishnah. Basically up until the Mishnah. And then the last 2,000 years are called the years of Mashiach. Meaning the years in which Mashiach could come. The years 4,000 to 6,000. The Mashiach has to come by 6,000. So the question is, does everybody follow this? This is one view on Mashiach. They ask the Chofetz Chaim, what would you do if you were living in the year 6,000 and Mashiach hadn't come yet? And what did he say? I'd have a Mariv. Meaning, what do you want me to do? Like, that's a Shita. Maybe the Mashiach won't come at 6,000. Maybe it'll come before. Maybe it'll come afterwards. We daven every day. The Mashiach could come now. Maybe the Mashiach could come now. Maybe the Mashiach could come in 300 years from now.
Isn't there also another Gemara that says that the world's going to be around for 6,000 years and then will be destroyed?
That's the Gemara I'm talking about.
But that's
the Gemara I'm talking about.
Right, so that's not... How can you, like, interpret that differently?
Maybe that's...
That it doesn't mean...
But we don't take every Agadic position in the Gemara and say that's authoritative and undisputed. There are many things which are stated, and in other places they're stated differently. For example, Rabbi Akiva, who saw the Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. That was before the year 4000. So if you take this statement that it's face value, the Mashiach can come from 4000 to 6000, well, Rabbi Akiva didn't agree with that because he thought Mashiach was coming before 4000. Or maybe Rabbi Akiva was in on this and he realized it was actually after 4000.
Yeah.
In other words, it becomes confusing, and maybe that's what it's meant to be. Don't forget, when it comes to Mashiach, the Rambam himself says, in Hilchos Mashiach, that whereas Chazal had clear Masorah on other areas of Torah, they had a clear Masorah on Halacha, they had a clear Masorah on Hashgacha, they knew Hilchos Shabbos and Hilchos Kashrus, we had Masorah to Sinai. That's fundamental to what, on Mashiach and Deif and all these issues, we had no clear Masorah. No clear Masorah. So the fact that there's lack of clarity in what Rabbi Schwab is talking about with these dates is almost part of our religion. So that's the question. Who obscured it? But everyone agrees it's obscure. The Rambam himself says what you must never do is give people a date for Mashiach. And then in his Igeres Teiman, he gives them a date for Mashiach, which came and passed and never happened. No, he gave them a date in the 1100s or early 1200s for Mashiach, having said that you don't give a date for Mashiach. Meaning, it's an area which is...
But
which
don't
is,
we know the day? Because
no, we do not. We do not know. And the 6000 may be true. It may be that we don't even know when the 6000 is. What's coming out of all of this is a confusion about Mashiach, which is fine. We're happy to be confused about Mashiach.
We don't need a year at all.
We don't need a year at all.
Why do we count years? If we
well, because on a practical basis, you've got to count something.
No, on a practical basis, if you know, this is a new year, so now we do everything in the year, the chagim and the month,
yeah,
and whatever, and then you know, okay, it's Rosh Hashanah, it's a new year. But like, if you don't know if it's 5775 or 5970,
what difference does it make?
Like,
no difference.
Why do you have one or the other?
The answer is, for much of history, we didn't have either. We had this minyan shtaros, and we had other minyanim. In other words, at the end of the day, it doesn't really make any difference. And by the way, when we say it's 5775, you read at the beginning of this article, the first 2 years are not calculated the same way anyway. Because the way we count in our calendar, year two begins, year one is the 5 days of creation. Year two begins on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the creation of Adam Arishon. Yeah? And year three is already when Adam Arishon has his first birthday, as it were. So even those years are not counting from creation in that same way. The answer is, I don't think it makes much difference, which is why I turned around and said at the very beginning of the class that on a scale of 1 to 1,000 or 100, I don't think we've discovered anything majorly problematic here. But what I'm interested in, as I said, is his methodology. Meaning, he takes the academics very seriously. He doesn't try and brush them away. He takes Chazal very seriously. He's not prepared to turn around and say that Chazal are just wrong. That's not an option that he feels is appropriate, because why would they just be wrong about this? They live just shortly thereafter. But he wants to try and find a middle ground which upholds both. Which I think is a very interesting approach. I want you to read his epilogue. Because his epilogue, written 30 years later... You're not happy about the Mashiach thing.
I'm not.
No, I understand that. You're not bothered by the academics.
No,
you're unhappy about the Mashiach thing because your Mashiach to come tomorrow morning. I understand that. I'm with you in terms of tefillah. But at the end of the day, the prayer that Mashiach comes tomorrow morning is very different than the expectation that Mashiach will come tomorrow morning. Meaning, Chazal said, rather Rambam said that one of the 13 principles of faith is we have to daven and warn that Mashiach could come. But we don't plan our lives around the obvious likelihood that Mashiach will come tomorrow morning, otherwise no one would bother building
it's
a house or...
It's not fair by Hashem to make us do that, because it's like us being on a treadmill and you're like, oh, you're going to get there, but we're just like...
Okay, so that was our Chiddush. Our Chiddush to the world, and this is a very important point we talk about with the Greeks. The Greeks said that time works like this. It's all like this. That's the treadmill. Meaning, the Greek version of time worked like this. It's all one big circle. You are bound in. There is no beginning. There is no end. That's Kadmas HaOlam, okay? And there's no way you can escape. You are bound by your fate. Oedipus, remember Oedipus? Oedipus, if you want to call him that.
Yeah.
Oedipus has to do what? He has to kill his father and marry his mother.
Yeah.
Does he have any ability to escape from that fate?
No.
No. He will, in the story of Oedipus, he does every single thing he can to avoid his mother and to avoid his father, and he ends up killing his father and sleeping with his mother, because he can't avoid his fate. Said the Jews, actually the opposite of what you're saying. The Jews came along and said, sorry, where's my thingy? Where?
Oh.
Where's my razor gone? Oh, thank you. The Jews came along and said, this is not the version of time. Actually, Bereshis Bara Elokim is a fundamental revolution in time. It means time starts here and it ends there. Mashiach, creation. There is a linear time model. It's almost the opposite of treadmill in the sense that there is a way of bringing things to a conclusion. We're not just caught in a loop that we can never get out of.
It's not unfair for Hashem
to say, daven and believe that Mashiach's going to come tomorrow, but don't actually expect it to, because it won't.
Except that maybe the belief in Mashiach will help us do something to make the world a better place to bring Mashiach, as opposed to leave ourselves to the fate, which is nothing we can do, and therefore anything we do is just a joke anyway. Maybe it's the belief in Mashiach that drives Jews to be what Jews are, which are Matakni Olam, that we make the world a better place. And this is the chiddush that we brought to the world. Why did Jews work so hard to improve the world, whether they're religious or not religious? It's a deep down belief that the world can be a better place, which the Greeks just didn't have. Because it can't be, can it, ever, really? Because it's all going to, what goes around comes around. So I don't think it's unfair. I think on the contrary, it gives us a certain kayach, which we bring to the world. That's why we win all these Nobel Prizes. That's why Israel sends people all the way to the other side of the world to rescue people from earthquakes, when the people that are living in the next country couldn't care less. It's this thing that drives us to believe that if it's not good, it can be good. Look at the epilogue, because I want you to see what happened with Rabbi Schwab 30 years later. Because this is also something of a reflection on the Jewish world. He wrote the first article in the 1960s. Would you say that article was brave, not brave? Would you say it was daring?
Yeah.
How do you, what do you think? Can you imagine somebody standing up and teaching that today in terms of the leaders of the Orthodox world? I don't think so much. So he brought the article out again in the 1970s. I didn't bring you the whole thing. In the 1990s, sorry. But look what he says. Epilogue. All the foregoing is based on an essay which was printed around 30 years ago in Ateret Tzvi, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Breuer's Jubilee volume, okay, to celebrate Dr. Breuer's life. Rabbi Dr. Breuer's life, and which was revised a few times. The purpose of this attempt was to assist the bewildered Torah true student of Jewish history sitting on the horns of a dilemma, and to strengthen their imunah. Now, how do you strengthen people's imunah according to Rabbi Schwab? You tell them problems, and you give them suggested solutions, and you make them aware of the issues and help them work them through. Meaning, you don't pretend that the problems don't exist, sweep them under the carpet, and pray to God that they never find out. Okay? If Rabbi Schwab said that in 1962, I think Kal v'chomer that's true in 2014, where there is nothing out there that you can't find out and won't find out, because everybody's on everyone's blog, and everyone's telling everything about everything. And if you are in any way intellectually intelligent or inquisitive, you will get access to everything. How can you not? It'll come your way one way or the other. Therefore, I think Rav Schwab's methodology is even more important today. Time and again, I was urged to publish this revised edition in order to serve a large readership. Meaning, people pushed Rabbi Schwab in order to make this known a bit more. Can you just turn it a bit warmer, please? Because Paul Michal's about to go blue. Thank you very much, Abby. So he said people wanted him to publish it again. But in the meantime, carry on. In the meantime, great doubts have bothered my mind and has made it mandatory for me to share my pangs of conscience. So what does he say? Now he tries to retract a little bit. Remember what he says? He says he's not sure if he's right. He says if the other people wanted to conceal it, who am I to reveal it? He says he's making various assumptions, which he's not sure is true. Although then he brings other evidence and say they may be true. He says Josephus doesn't mention it. And he wouldn't have kept quiet. In other words, he brings in a bunch of doubts where he says, I'm not sure if my theory is true. Look at E for a second. One letter writer suggested to me that the most ancient documents are so unclear, confusing, and self-contradicting that we do not have to take the conclusion of modern historians seriously. In this case, no conflict exists. Now, does Rabbi Schwab agree with that?
No.
He doesn't agree with that. Because he said in the beginning of his article, the evidence is overwhelming. Is there less evidence in 1990? Probably not. So why is he writing that?
Probably pressure.
Maybe a bit of pressure. Maybe he's feeling the people have been going a bit nuts with him for raising these issues. And by 1990 already, the Orthodox world was a bit less broad and accepting than it was in the 1960s. And he feels he has to write that, which is interesting. Or maybe Taki believes that there are things which are not as clear as you think that they were. One other thing here. Rav Sajigon. He brings Rav Sajigon, which is fascinating. Rav Sajigon actually mentions this in Emunas V'Deus already in the 900s. He says the reason that there's a discrepancy, says Rav Sajigon, is Christianity put the 160 years in. It's not that we took them out. It says Christianity put them in order to readjust the dating for the birth of Jesus. Which is very interesting in and of itself, because Daniel makes a prophecy of 490 years. There's going to be 490 years until something happens. And now, Seder Olam Rabbah understood that to be 70 years of exile and 420 years of Beit HaMikdash. And Rav Sandigon says that the Christians, I actually read this last night, I reread it, he says the Christians wanted to say the 490 years are designed to lead up to the birth of Jesus. Because remember, what the Christians did is they went through the whole of the Tanakh and tried to find Christological references that would refer them to the birth of Jesus. And therefore that's how, says Rav Sadigon, the calendar ended up getting changed. That's actually very interesting, because that's quite plausible on a certain level. But that doesn't help with all the modern day cuneiform discoveries that seem to mean that it really was those dates. Yes. Right.
And obviously some of them are true or false. There's multiple truths, but there's not multiple truths in what actually happened.
Right.
That's the point to say history is true or false. That's the whole point of the day. We know this, but which one is the true one?
So I think maybe what he's saying there is he's saying on a scientific basis, if I create a theory as to maybe this happens, and that's what fits with these sukkim, that doesn't make it true because it either happened or it didn't happen. Meaning even if my theory is excellent and it fits with lots of evidence, that doesn't make it correct. Now, I actually want to come back and support Rabbi Schwab from the 1960s and say, well, no, maybe it does make it correct. Meaning, what's Seder Olam Rabbah doing when it's going making these dating of years? We get back to the point that we made before when we talked about Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. From a religious perspective, when we're looking at Psukim, and we're trying to work out what they mean, and Daniel, and this and that and the other, how bothered actually are we by the exact historical truth of what's going on? And I want to suggest that not necessarily that bothered. Meaning, is Seder Olam Rabbah trying to set out a history book because it's important that Jews learn history? Or is Seder Olam Rabbah trying to set out an understanding of Psukim because it's important that Jews understand Psukim? You hear what I'm saying? That if you want to study history, so study history. If you want to study Tanakh, so study Tanakh. But is Tanakh history? Now there's obviously an overlap.
Yes.
It's not ahistorical. It's not something which is like not history. But the study of Tanakh should not be the same as the study of history. And the study of Daniel should not be the same as the study of cuneiform.
Why isn't that history? Daniel happened in the past.
It is something that happened in the past, but the way we learn it is not necessarily the way that we learn history. In other words, it also talks about the creation of the world, but it's not science either. You hear what I'm saying? Meaning that why are you picking up the book of Daniel? To work out what happened with the ancient Greek Persian period? Is that why you're reading the book of Daniel?
No.
Why are you reading the book of Daniel?
Why?
Why? Why do you need to learn what happened?
The Torah was written as a history book. It was written for the people that were supposed to read it.
Right. It's written in order to give you important understandings in
religion,
spirituality, connection with God, etc., etc. Now, if you go away and find that the cuneiform record says that Seder Olam Rabbah is not correct, does that mean you have to throw everything, the whole Tanakh into the sky and say, like, you know, I'm not interested anymore? Any more than if you find some evolution theory that says that you don't think... No, not at all. Absolutely not. This guy who wrote this book, okay, is clearly a Ma'amin. It's clearly someone who is from. It's clearly someone who understands. And he went through all of the data. He brings his own theory at the end as to what happened to the years. Everyone has their own theory. He has a different theory as to why Seder Olam Harabah wrote it that way. I saw another thing. I brought you a link to an article here at the bottom of page 2. I brought you a link to an article in a book called Hakira. There is a journal called Hakira. You can get it online. Thanks very much. Sorry, I'm just like throwing everything around the room. It's like a baby who throws all his toys out of the car. Yeah? Have you ever come across this journal called Hakira? You probably haven't. There's so much good stuff online, you know? So much that you can read. Hakira is a journal produced in Flatbush. It's meant to deal with some academic issues and Torah issues. Most of the articles I've read there are actually very good indeed. And there's an article about the dating issue. They want to say in that article, it's about 70 pages long, I didn't ask you to read it. It's like, goes through all of the you know, the nitty gritty of the kings and the this and the that and the evidence and the Bible, the cuneiform and all that kind of stuff. The guy probably sat in the British Museum for 3 years trying to work it all out. There he suggests that the years were changed in order to make the 2,000 years of Torah exactly from Avram to the Mishnah. The point here is that what we're dealing with here is Torah, not history. I think it's very important to understand that. And this is a very fascinating microcosmic example of how you deal, or how Rabbi Schwab dealt, or how he dealt in the 1960s, and then maybe dealt differently in the 1990s, with a conflict between Torah and what seems to be an academic record. Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman said a very interesting thing. Let's go to page 2 for a second, and I'll give you some final thoughts. Just look at what I put in terms of on page 2 in terms of the possible resolutions. First of all, I gave a reference to this book, which if you're interested, you can read, and if you're not, then you don't have to. So, here, look. Three possible solutions. Maybe the Seder Olam Rabbah is correct and the conventional chronology is not correct. Meaning, we believe in Masorah, okay? Masorah is important to us. It's relevant to the Jewish calendar. Do we believe the calendar is wrong? Is scientific data reliable? Look at the Chazon Ish for a second. Look at the Chazon Ish in number 4. The Chazon Ish is a classic position, which I think is not one that Rabbi Schwab would agree with. Shneit Bais Sheni Batuach Medivre Chazal. The Chazon Ish says, we know how long Bais Sheni was. He doesn't say what I just said, Oria, about history is one thing and Torah is another. He doesn't agree with that at all. He says, we know the years of Bais Sheni from Chazal's words. The Al Ha'adam, what should a person do? Le Garesh Mikirbo. What does that mean? Le Garesh. To send out, you should get rid from inside you of any hirhurim, any thoughts, bedavar, on the matter. You should not think about this issue. The ashrei misha loikara besvarim achitzoinim. What does it mean? Ashrei misha loikara besvarim achitzoinim. Right. Happy people are people who never read anything secular. On a certain level. And is he right or is he wrong? It depends who your customers are. Meaning, for some people, there's no question. There's no mitzvah to make people aware of problems just so that they know there are solutions to the problems and they never even know there were problems. Rav Yehuda Cooperman. You know who Rav Yehuda Cooperman is? You're sitting here in this room because of Rav Yehuda Cooperman. Rav Yehuda Cooperman founded Michlala many, many years ago. He's Irish. He's still alive. He's a very old man. Should live and be well to 120. He's a very special person. And he was the one that really first founded the idea of having high level, academically, you know, with integrity, a women's education in English for an English speaking audience. There would be no seminaries like MNY if it wasn't for the original Michlala. Michlala has gone through a number of different changes over the years, but the Cooperman family is still very involved. Rav Yehuda Cooperman was asked many years ago to translate Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman's Perush al Chumash. Have you heard of Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman? Where did he live? Germany. When? Beginning of the 20th century. He wrote a commentary on the Chumash that deals with the issue of biblical criticism. The Graf-Wellhausen theory of the documentary hypothesis, which is multiple authors for Torah and all that kind of stuff. His whole parish goes through the Chumash showing that the documentary hypothesis is ridiculous for this reason and that reason doesn't hold together, and there's a lot of stuff in the documentary hypothesis that really doesn't hold together, and yet they still teach it in Jewish studies departments as if it's like Torah Misinai, and yet the theory is 170 years old and has 1,000 caches on it. But that's not for now. He was asked to translate Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman's parish on the Chumash into English, and he refused. Why? Because he said, nobody's bothered by biblical criticism these days. This was about 20 years ago. And therefore, why should I bring to the attention of the public all these wonderful answers to questions that they don't have? I hear that. Absolutely. I'm not sure that there is a... I grapple with this as an educator constantly. Should I make you aware of things that disturb your understanding of Torah in order to put it back together again more in a more sophisticated way? Or should I leave you with your simplistic understanding of Torah? Or my own? Which is better? Which would you prefer, girls? Would you prefer that I stir you up in order to put it together again, but you're less happy than you were at the beginning? Or would you prefer ignorance is bliss?
Our preference is obvious. It depends on what school of thought you belong
Right. And it depends on your customers. Meaning, my shita on this is that you guys are going out into the secular world. Yeah? You're not going to be able to follow the Chazanish's approach because that's not the lives you're going to lead. Since that's not the life you're going to lead, then you have a chiyuv to understand how to make a shiluv, how to make a connection. People in this room are going to Stern College, probably, some of them. Okay? Torah Umada. That's what it says on the crest. What does Torah Umada mean? 1,000 things to 1,000 different people, I know. But on a certain level, Torah Umada means that Torah is true and Mada is serious and you can't denigrate either of them. You have to find some way of putting them on the same crest together. That doesn't mean Torah is as important. It doesn't mean that secular studies are as important as Torah. That's not what it means at all. But it means that somehow there has to be this magic word synthesis. It means you have to make things live with each other. At the end of the day, that's what Rabbi Schwab is doing. Rabbi Schwab is not a Torah or Mada person, don't get me wrong. And I'm not sure he would have been that excited about Yeshiva University today, or even when he was alive 20, 30 years ago. But I want you to understand this methodology is important because that's where you're coming from, girls, and that's probably where you're going to. The Chazanish's approach has a lot going for it, but it depends who you're teaching. On the other hand, to turn around and say Sefer Olam Rabbah is wrong, Chazal are wrong, they just got the wrong evidence, they didn't know any better, I don't think that's acceptable either. To turn around and say about Chazal that they just didn't know what they were talking about, that is a very difficult thing to say. On some areas we can sometimes say that, like when it comes to medical issues. The Rambam is prepared to say Chazal's advice on the medical world was gleaned from the world of medicine that they knew at the time, and therefore the Rambam's opinion on Chazal's opinion on science. On Chazal's opinion on science, yeah, absolutely. And therefore you can say that sometimes, but even that's very controversial today, and you can ask Rabbi Nathan Slifkin about that one day. But the point here is that you have to somehow grapple with this issue. And the reason I brought you this 165 years was threefold. Number one, you need to know about it. Number two, it's relevant for where we are at the moment in terms of the Second Temple period, because we're almost at the Greeks, and the Greeks, isn't it nice and coincidental that we just get to the Greeks for Hanukkah? Okay? And did I plan it that way? Yes. And the last thing is the methodology, which I think is the most important of all, which is you will come across these issues in future, if not this one, then others. You need to have a system whereby you can deal with it somehow. You won't leave this room happy, but you'll leave this room thinking, which is the best I can do right now. All right?